WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. It says so right here on my shirt and on the screen. And of course, another Baltimore Positive episode here. It's been a long time coming for this one. The great meeting of the media minds together with Don Mohler, former Baltimore County Executive. Want to give a shout out to our sponsors before we get going, because there's no question that we would have loved to have had Mark Steiner out at State Fair with the chicken and waffles and the shrimp and grits, and Don Mohler doing the big press of coffee, and them coming back and saying, "Do you want more?" And him saying, "No, I shouldn't, but sure, give me more." Or down at Fadley's with a crab cake, of course, with Damien. I stopped by and had a crab cake. I've got some mac and cheese in my fridge right now that I'm going to heat up a little later on as well. Mohler and Gary Realty still selling and buying homes and doing things and closing deals and wearing masks and getting you to closing and doing a lot of things virtually. You'll want to find them out at Mohler and Gary. I'm going to get Jeff on the program after the election as well. And last but not least, Taharka, local. I've got the Honey Graham here. I think I might just start drinking, right out of these Taharka things here. But they're made in Baltimore. It's the best ice cream that I've had. Awaken more than just your taste buds. And we're going to have a whole bunch of the crew from Taharka around here at WNST and Baltimore Positive. Don, this guy's an old friend of yours. And, I'm not going to date myself here too much. And I've already insulted a couple of ladies this week calling myself an old-timer and them an old-timer. But Mark Steiner's an old-timer, and, I go back to the days of at the newspaper in the late 80s and early 90s, and, man, I love me an iconoclast. I love me a rabble-rouser, and I am just delighted to bring this together, but I have never met or spoken to Mark Steiner that I'm aware of, so this is going
to
be fun.
I'm going to start there, because Mark is a good buddy. We go way back. He's interviewed me. He's interviewed my bosses. He was always tough. He was always fair. Mark, I remember the day Kevin Kamenich absolutely insisted on leaving the office and coming over and surprising you on your last day. At Morgan, and that's a great memory that I will always have. Nestor Kevin popped right into the studio unannounced and just wanted to wish Mark well on his next journey. Let me start with this, fellas. How do two media icons like yourself, two legends in Baltimore radio, how can we be sitting here in 2020 and you two have never met? That doesn't even compute to me.
It is crazy, but it's true. I mean, we know each other's work. You're right, Nestor. We never have really met, have we?
No. This is in modern technology, and Don, we talk so much about stats and numbers and mapping and police and all this stuff. I'll give you a little mapping here. Mark Steiner and I have 229 mutual Facebook friends. Okay, now LinkedIn. Hold on a second here. Let me see Mark Steiner on LinkedIn. We are not linked together. But we have 91, we will be in a minute, Center for Emerging Media, here we go, host and executive producer Mark Steiner Show, 91 mutual LinkedIn friends. So we got that going for us, Mark. How about that?
We should run into this. When COVID is done, then the beer's on me.
Well, and the crab cake's on me.
We will remedy this. Mark, there is so much to talk about, and in this digital age, you are absolutely one of my favorite Facebook follows, because very often you write what I will say are essays on topics, and you have such a diverse group of friends that it really becomes very much like the old barbershop or down at the corner store where people are exchanging ideas. We're going to give you plenty of time to talk about what you're doing, Mark. But before we get to that, let's just talk. I don't normally let Nestor talk about national politics because his head explodes. But we're not going to have you on without getting your take on what in the world is happening at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and then by extension, what it says about our nation. Give me the Steiner take on all this.
I have a couple of quick takes. One is, I think we're facing the most dangerous and important moment in our American political history since the 19th century. And I go back to 1877. 1877 is when Rutherford B. Hayes became president of the United States, and with a minority of the vote. And he was pushed into office by the Redemptionist Democrats, who were the former Southern Confederates and founders of the Klan, and moderate Republicans who were trying to get power back from the radical Republicans who were pushing the Reconstruction. So for Arthur B. Hayes becomes president. He becomes president and ends Reconstruction and pulls federal troops out of the South. That led to 90 years of abject terror against African Americans in this country. It began the whole system of putting Native people on reservations and went off and went after to destroy the nascent budding union movement in our country in the 1880s. So all that kind of transpired then. And though, as Mark Twain says, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often mimics. And we're in that mimic period. I don't know what it might bring, but what I do know is that the forces around Trump are, to me, more dangerous than Trump himself. And Trump, I think, is, like, not that bright. I think he's a real huckster. And he just shoots off the cuff because he doesn't think very deeply. But there are men and women around him that have renamed the conservative, really right wing, not just conservative, legal minds and organizations have now placed the third of the federal court judges in place under him. He signs off on whatever they give him. He's surrounded by, I think, people who have some white nationalists and very racist ideologies. And I think that it's we're really fighting for not just Republican and Democrat or Biden, you know, or Biden versus Trump, but really this has to do with the soul and the future of our country and where we're going. And I think it's that serious a moment.
Don would always say, this is not who we are. You know, five, 6 years ago, you know, when Don's speaking out as much as he did when he worked in government, much, just saying, this is not who we are. And he would say, you would sit at football games with me, Don, and say, this isn't who we are. Then you become county executive. I don't hear you saying that anymore because, and I did the math in the city, and I know we're going to get to the city vote. City voted 89.5% against Trump. So that's how disliked he is where I live, right? Like 9 out of 10 is where we are. And then I see these national polls and I see 43% or I see 46% on a day, you know, when something went right in the stock market. I am appalled, Mark. It's like so appalled that I don't talk about it as much as I should. And when I do, I want it to have impact because I could sit on social media all day, all night. I could be obsessed with it. I've instead decided to do something empowering about it, you know, as a citizen and turning my conversation away from baseball box scores for 30 years to pull up my old guidance counselor from 1982 at Dundalk High, Don Moeller, and say, Don, I got 168 hours a week of radio here. You know what I mean? Steiner would love to have that. What do we do with it? You know, what can we do positively to be an antidote to this nonsense? And the depth of this for me is the Orwellian thought that I would never know people who have been whatever, brainwashed, whatever you would call it, to watching this clown act at 6 o'clock every night and saying, yeah, that's my guy. Like I just never thought that would happen. And Don, you would always say in a parental way to me, you know, this isn't who we are. This isn't who we are. And Mark, I've traveled the world. I mean, I've had a very fortunate go in life. I always say that to Brian Billick, our partner here, on behalf of Living Classrooms Foundation. I say, I've been around the world. I travel places and go places with an American passport. And I see how we're perceived by others. And how that's changed dramatically and how our city has changed and how our country has changed and pockets of our country have changed. But philosophically, I guess this is who we are because this is who we are right now. But to all of our point in November, this is where we get to stand up and go back to Don's way of, this isn't who we are. This is unacceptable. It's unacceptable for our children.
Since you've invoked that a couple times, and I'm going to throw this back to Mark. I know both of you have seen me express this on social media. This isn't who we are is probably what scares me. And Mark, you alluded to this when you said others being more dangerous than Trump himself. What scares me the most about November 4th, the morning after the election this fall, is that we might wake up and have to look at each other and potentially say, I didn't want to believe this is who we are, but perhaps it is who we are. And Mark, you're such a social historian, and really, I think almost an anthropologist in the way that you look at culture and cultural issues. How do you explain what is happening with that somewhere between 40 and 46, 47, 48% that are just unshakable, and Trump seems to have bought out their worst instincts? Give us a historical or an anthropological look as to what you think's happening there.
Ooh, well, I mean, let me start off with the positive. the numbers that support Trump and will continue to support Trump, no matter what happens, are, I guess, for the first time in American history, actually not the majority of Americans. With that kind of thinking. Which is a real difference. Our electoral college system is built to, is really an anachronistic institution that needs to go, and which is why Trump could win again, even without the popular vote. So, I mean, if you think of the history of our country, look, when you say that, you know, this is not who we are, in some ways it's not who we are, but in some ways it is who we are. I mean, and we've always, it's always been this battle, for want of a better term. It's almost like, you know, almost like a dialectical struggle. It's been, whether you're both Buddhists and Marxists, use dialectics to explain the world. You know, I mean, it's just how things interact, and it. I'm sorry. Some call was coming in, distracting me. So let me get back to what I was saying. I apologize. So I think that America has always had this huge reactionary element, always. I mean, think about it. I mean, we were a country that enslaved African Americans for hundreds of years, and it is so that reactionary racist part of our country is very real. But so is the other. And the dynamic we're seeing now is that this is a battle over who we are and what we want to become. You know, from the 1930s. Until the 1970s, a huge uproar happened in this country, and we changed things. Social Security happened. We began Medicare, Medicaid. We ended legal segregation. We passed equal rights bills. I mean, there were black folks were elected to Congress in huge numbers, as well as various Latinos and women, and things began to change. And from the 1971 memo that Powell, when they became Justice Powell, wrote to these corporate leaders on the right saying, we have to take America back. There's been this surge over those last almost 50 years where there's been a battle to regain the country taken back from people who have actually changed it, as I would argue, have moved it forward. And forces are trying to contain that and push it back. And so I think we're in the most significant political battle of our lifetime. I mean, you know, as a kid, I was in the civil rights movement, and I went to jail a whole lot.
I'm proud of you for that, Mark.
Well, you know, it was 60 years ago when I walked my first picket line at Mondawmin Shopping Center.
Just before Mark, I remember. 14. I'm going to interrupt you from consent because Nestor wasn't there. They had a dinner honoring Mark, and Mark, one of my favorite moments that night. I can't remember who was speaking. It was one of the African American leaders, Nestor. And he joked that, you know, when they were in jail or when they were out on the front lines, Mark would be saying, you know, we got to show the man. We got to stand up to the man. We got to stand up to the white man. And finally, Mark laughing, the African-American leader turned to Mark and said, Mark, you do realize that you're a white man. Remember that story, Mark?
I do, yes, very well.
Mark, where did that come from? I mean, Nestor said he's proud of that. Where did that commitment to social justice, I mean, because you said, I mean, you've been on the front lines since the 60s, and you've been, you know, assaulted, thrown in jail, beaten up. Where did that sense and that desire to make a difference and fight for social justice come from in your life?
I'll tell you really quick, and I don't want to dominate this, but I'll tell you real fast. A lot of the credit goes to my mother. My mother was a Brit, and who met my father in World War II. She was an ambulance driver who dragged people out of the rubble when the Nazi rockets hit Britain. And she...
That's your mom. The closest I've come is I toured the bunkers of Churchill. Just... That's a close, but I mean, then I have somebody like you giving me those stories. That's just a little different, you know.
Well, I give this. My mother, when she married my dad in 1944, and they in World War II, she gave my father Richard Wright's novel Black Boy, a first edition, and said, and the description in the book is for him, so he can understand his country better. So that was my mom, right? So so when I was 11, I wanted to be a Boy Scout more than anything in the world because Boy Scouts meant so much to me as a little kid. And so so I ran downstairs to the kitchen and said, Mom, I have to be a Boy Scout. I'm going to turn 11. It was at the kitchen table, that breakfast table with Mrs. Moselle Jackson, who was a black woman who was domestic in our home, and her nephew, Mr. Dennis Foster. And I said, Mom said, all right. She said, all right, love. We're signing off straight away Monday morning, Beth Tefillah. I said, Mom, I don't want to be in a shul with all Jews. Of course, this was 57, and everything was segregated in Baltimore. And then Dennis Foster said, I'm a Scout Master. You can join my troop. And I'll never forget my mother. And she tilted her head and had this twinkle in her eye and a smile. And she said, oh, that would be a lovely idea. She knew exactly what was good.
And so I ended up being an all-black Boy Scout troop.
At the Faith Baptist Church on Ashland Avenue in East Baltimore.
Is this the picture on the front of your Facebook?
That's my scout troop. That's my scout troop.
Well, you know, it is interesting that we'll take this from here to the White House, and then we bring it back down to City Hall. Mark Steiner is with us, the legend, of course, on Baltimore Positive. The Scouts Honor, right? Like, I probably should Google that and say, what is the Scouts Honor, and read it out loud, right? The oath that you take, honorable
right.
standards, and then every night we sit up and see... absolute dishonor. You know, my father, Don and I had a long chat about my father and my growing. My dad grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania and stood in the soup lines in 1929, chicken in every pot, never voted for a Republican again after Hoover when he was 10 years old, you know. And I kid Ted Venatoulis about standing around. But my dad was a square Eisenhower, you know, FDR, Kennedy, that era. I was raised that way because he was born in 1919, much older. But there's honor, right? Scout's honor is, you mean what you say, and there's integrity behind that. That is really the part of this, I think, for all of us who believe we've been raised that way or have had integrity. And Don's told stories about the way he was raised. And we've talked to so many people on Baltimore Positive. One of the recurring themes, as Don would say, is we always ask, how were you raised? And you know, where did this come from for everyone? It is amazing that at the heart of all of this was some sort of Scout's honor, right? For all of us.
I remember the oath. I'll tell it, but it went like this, I think.
Go ahead.
You put three fingers in the air, which was the scout salute, right? And you said, on my honor, I will do my best to do my duty to God and my country and to obey the scout law, to help other people at all times, to keep myself physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight. And then there was the scout law. And then you said, a scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, courteous, friendly, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent.
I'm reading this off the internet and mouthing the words while you actually know them.
I mean, it's because they actually look. I mean, they're to be raised with what that's the part of the beauty of America to me is that you know we have a moral core in this country, and despite the fact that our founding fathers wrote these laws for white men of property. They were universal, and they inspired people who are fighting for freedom and equality in our own country and across the globe, those words, what the documents they made. And so, you know, and that's part of who we are as Americans. And so we've been fighting that battle since the beginning, and we have an opportunity now to take our country to new heights and be the kind of place that we should be as a nation, that we've always struggled to be. You know, and I think that's the place we find ourselves in at this moment. And to be a Boy Scout, at least back in our days, meant that, you know, was part and parcel to that. It was, well, you were a Scout, right, Don?
No, I was a Cub Scout, never made it to the Boy Scouts.
I was a Cub Scout, and I was a Weeblo. I never made it to the Boy Scouts.
Right. I can't tell you why. I can't even tell you why. You know, it was. I assume that I just.
I think I discovered girls. I think that's what happened.
And I think I ended up hung up on playing sports. But Mark, sticking with those whole idea, that whole idea of the values, I've had some suggest to me in the last week that the media does us a disservice when they focus on these armed white protesters with AK-47s descending on the steps of Michigan and other places in the United States. And they here's the disservice they say, and I'm curious how you what your take is on this. They say those folks are such a minority that they really are the extreme. They don't represent mainstream America or even those who are slightly right of center for what it's worth, that they're really a minority, and by shining the light on them, we make them appear bigger than they are. What's your take on how those kinds of protests of these folks with AK-47s in the streets should be covered?
Well, it's a really difficult question. I mean, from the days of when I was just doing the journalism straight up, you know, you've got to cover it because it's there and it happens. You can't ignore it. But, you know, I think that they're a very, how can I put this? It's a really dangerous element. I mean, I remember one of the things that I saw on Facebook once from one of the people I know who's a really avid Trump supporter. And it was on there. It said, American hunters are the third largest army on the planet. We know how to stalk, shoot, and take down what we want. And so I don't take that lightly. I've hunted before, so I'm not anti-hunters. I'm just saying that particular that particular statement was like you said to me that what we face is a clear and real danger.
Well, it's the first time in the history of mankind that, you know, within my breathing space, there are people with machinery that could take out the whole neighborhood.
Yeah. And look, I mean, there was an article in Truth Out, I think that was written recently by a guy named Chauncey DeVega about the far-right extremists and their hope to incite a civil war. So they may be a minority, but they're a significant minority of 6 to 10% of the American people. And you don't. It doesn't take that much to foment and create that kind of armed violence. It doesn't take that much to start.
Well,
and how
Mark,
it expands from there.
It's interesting that you reference the desire to foment a civil war. I had a back and forth with a couple of friends last week who were frustrated that the state police didn't swarm in and forcibly remove all those folks from Michigan. And one of my takes on the situation was that I'm not sure that some of those folks aren't willing to become martyrs for that cause and actually were looking to provoke an armed confrontation where there was this shootout on the State House of Michigan. So as you said earlier, this is an extremely, extremely complex issue. When you use that, Mark, and this whole strange national climate that we are in, what do you make of the presidential election as it's going to evolve? Joe Biden, who sort of has to have been locked in his basement as a result of COVID, regardless of who he picks as his vice presidential candidate. What's your sense of how this election is going to play out and what the strategy is going to be on both sides?
Well, I think that, first of all, the Republican Party at this moment has a unshakable vote that is not going anywhere. That vote is anywhere from 40 to 48% of the American people voting. Right?
I agree.
That's unshakable. And that's how deep that divide is. And I think it's almost like it's like in the city election. like Shilla Dixon has an unshakable bolt that will never go anywhere. And
we'll get to that.
I'm not comparing her to Trump.
But you see her. But we're going to talk about the city election. But since you brought it up, do you see that it's about her vote somewhere between 20% and 23%? It's not going anywhere.
It's possible. It could be that high.
Yeah.
It's
okay.
Possible.
Okay.
It's possible.
I'm sorry. We'll go back to the seat. Jump back to the national race then.
But my biggest fear in that election is the Democrats don't have their act together. They really don't. I mean, strategically, I don't see the National Democrats really organizing it the way they have to organize it to win this election. I mean, they have to realize that we are stuck with an electoral college. And so the majority of people in New York and California and Oregon and Washington and other states may vote for Biden and Democrats. But if they don't focus on the states that are possible swing states and states that can swing over, they're going to lose the election. And I think that's the real danger here. Now, that my fear is that they don't have it together, that the Democratic establishment is so hung up and worried about blunting the power of the progressive movement, the left, however you want to call it, inside the Democratic Party, that they're spending too much time focusing on that and not enough time focusing on what it means to stop Trump from winning again. That's my biggest fear.
Mark, I'm gonna say that you get a phone call this week, and it's from Anita Dunn, one of Joe Biden's senior advisors, and she says, "Mark, I've been following your career. We want you on the inside. We want you to be in a kitchen cabinet. Give me five things that you would say to the Biden team that they ought to be doing right now."
A, you need to have a ground game in the swing states and the three states that went to, especially those three states that went to Trump in the last election, in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. You've got to really focus on those three places, pull out the vote, organize the vote, reach out to the communities of color, reach out to disaffected working class, reach out to the basic supporters, bring them in to vote and make sure they get to the polls or they get their ballots mailed in. And because you're going to have to battle against the voter suppression, which they're going to attempt to do. That's A. B is to really come up with a truce inside the Democratic Party and reach out and saying we have to unite here, and get Bernie and get AOC and get Ed Markey and others to reach out to their constituents and say, we really need you to unite, and this is what we're gonna compromise here, so we can unite.
That's really difficult to do when they can't get in a room and get on a plane, and there can't be trust established when you're trying to put together a cabinet, not only to run the country after you win, but the lead up of having some level of confidence. Whoever those people in the middle are that are going to make the difference, especially in those states, they have to be bought in. Which is there's only gonna be one vice president, right? I mean, he can offer different things to different people, but what it means to the electorate is probably about who he picks as a VP, right?
You know, people always historically say that VPs don't make much difference when you're running in an election, and I think that was historically true. It may be different now, especially given the racial and gender dynamics in this country. So, I mean, I think politically, I said so that it makes more of a difference now. Though, I mean, the Democrats need a strategy that's really kind of layered, depending on who they're talking to and who they're trying to pull out. You know, I mean, the African American community and the Mexican American community, Puerto Rican community, other Latino communities are going to come out for Biden in large majorities.
I think the amazing part is 9 weeks into a pandemic that the country is not completely up at arms at how the country has been run. Like the fact that so many people I know that pulled the lever for this clown still somehow all this way through defended it is. It's shocking to me. It really, really is. Especially now that the stock market's gone too, right? And the unemployment's incredible. It really is incredible that we could, that you would have to do any more as a Democratic Party than say that. You literally just point at it and say that or this. And the fact that they can't do that's astonishing to me. This late in the game where I can't leave the house without a mask and gloves, right?
Well, yeah, that's the third thing Democrats should be doing. I mean, if I was running the DNC, I'd be getting the most brilliant minds around the country to put together a on-air digital TV Facebook campaigns attacking Trump and attacking how bad they're handling this, and we're reminding people of what could and should be done instead of what they're doing. I mean, I don't understand why they're not doing that. Why aren't they pouring millions of dollars into this campaign that goes out to the media that people actually use? That's what I'm saying. The Democrats are just not. They're not playing their A game here, and they should be. I don't quite
understand. Well, nor is the media, Mark, to be really honest, right? I mean, this guy gets up every day and talks about injecting bleach. He looks like a drug addict. He acts like a drug addict. He calls the media the enemy of the state. He says voting is a privilege and not a right. It just goes on and on and on. The manipulation of minds is really, I think, at the heart of all of this, right?
Yes, absolutely. No, it is. I mean, it's where I have this conversation, I'm getting really frustrated here.
No.
We are Baltimore positive. We'll get to the election.
It's why I was only half joking when I said that we don't allow Messer to talk about this as a regular part of Baltimore Positive, because number one, we do find it depressing, and it does make Nestor's head explode. God forbid, we really shouldn't use Hitlerian or Nazi references. I've always resisted that in public life. I don't think it serves us well, but it is difficult not to make connections to Goebbels and the big lie when you do see how easily Trump is able to manipulate a portion of the American public with phrases like, well, some people said so, or I heard this. And then before you know it, it becomes a fact how he can on one day, Mark, say something that, and the best example, I went back and forth yesterday with someone on social media. I mean, I happened, like millions of Americans, to have been watching the day he suggested to the doctors that we need to see if it's possible to in some way be able to ingest bleach inside a body to attack the virus. Now, because he later came out and said he didn't say that, his followers to this day want to continue to maintain that is an exaggeration. That's a bit of fake news. And he didn't say that.
Virus was a Democratic hoax, right?
Right.
They've run away from that one.
Right.
That never existed.
Right. So what I think,
except that it
did. And Mark, I hear your frustration, but in response to this, I think it is very difficult to put together a playbook in a race where your opponent just doesn't tell the truth, and where your opponent has some strange hold over his followers that makes them believe whatever he says from today. It's a very different landscape than what most elected officials have been used to doing.
What's the word for that? It's cult, right? Cult.
Right. What'd you say? It's what?
Cult.
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 Cult. Cult. Cult. Cult. Cult.
Yes.
I mean... This is a
system of religious veneration and devotion directed toward a particular figure or object. There you go.
How can I put this? I mean, Trump, in some ways, you might say, embodies that to people. But what it really is that people know that in power, they can use Trump to get what they want. And they're getting everything they want. And I think Trump is the vehicle. He's a huckster. He's a showman. You know, and I think there's a lot of people who just really enjoy a president who goes F you to Americans or all the standards we hold. You know, that's part of
that
it.
That would make you not an American, in my opinion. But
and I think you're right, Mark. I've written about this several times in my blog, in the sense that I think that folks have been willing to make the quote unquote deal with the proverbial devil because he has been able to accomplish things that they believe. For example, I have, and I made a rule years ago, I never discuss the abortion issue with people. I've never seen anyone change their mind. They're usually deeply held positions on whichever side of that issue you are. But I do believe this, that for whatever percentage of Americans that is their number one issue, and you could say it's somewhere between 20 and 35% that would be their number one issue. For those folks, they're never budging on Trump at all, regardless of what he does, because on that issue, they perceive him as their champion. And I think there are a number of these issues. He certainly has tried to do that with the Second Amendment. So I think he's masterful at identifying what we would call these sort of big cultural issues and making, which you identified earlier, Mark, that 40 to 48% say, I may be crazy as hell, but you know on these big issues I've got your back, and they don't. And that, to me, is what makes possible another Electoral College victory.
Well, the fascinating part is the 20 to 35% also don't realize that he's also paid for abortions as well, right? So doesn't even really share their belief.
And 20 years ago, he said, I am completely pro-choice.
Right. Right. No, it doesn't matter because, as you said earlier, Mark, the carny nature in him allows him to figure out what moves the masses and goes forward. Again, we're with longtime Baltimore media figure, social activist, civil rights activist, Mark Steiner. Mark, before we get you to fill us in on what's happening with emerging media, because you're doing all kinds of neat stuff, I can't have you on. Longtime city resident, longtime city activist, without talking a little bit about the mayor's race. We're not going to ask you to endorse anyone unless within the last 24 hours or so you have and we missed it, or you want to make news, we'll let you make news. But before we get into the candidates, talk about what Baltimore needs in a mayor here in 2020. Talk about the big picture. Talk about mayor in terms of qualities and attributes as opposed to the particular candidates. What do you want to see in a mayor?
Oh, well, first of all, I think we need whoever is the next mayor. There has to be someone taking us forward and not be taking us backwards on many levels. And it's someone who really understands the city from the bottom up, who can understand that the only way for us to, in the long run, defeat the crime-ridden nature of our streets, especially inner-city streets, is economic development, is saying things like, is understanding that if you give a TIF, if you bring in a business, if you are going to do construction business in the city, whatever it is, that you have to hire people in this city. The only way out of the morass of dystopian poverty that fuels the violence in our community is stability and bringing people into a life where they can actually have a family and build community like we used to have in this city. Even in our toughest communities when we were kids, and I was in many of those toughest communities when I was a kid, the difference was that I told one of my producers who's now working for Brandon Scott as we were driving through the city one day, I said, all these houses here that are abandoned and empty shells, when I was a kid, this was a tough-ass neighborhood. You had to fight on the corner. Things happened. People hustled. There were tough communities.
You had one or two scuffles along the way, Mark.
I had a few. I had a few. The difference was that every one of these empty houses was filled with families, with fathers and mothers and uncles and aunts and grandmothers taking care of each other, working, whether you were running an A-Rabbers card or working at Buffalo and Steel or were a doctor, whatever it was, people were working and living together. So we have to rebuild our city, not go backwards, but build it for the future. Someone has a vision to how to do that. That's really important because, you know, we can be tough on the knuckleheads who are causing the worst violence. That's fine. We have to stop that. You can't live like that. But it's the larger picture we have to get a hold of. We have to understand what restorative justice is about, to bring people back whole as human beings to rebuild a community. People understand that, and how to do that is really important, and how to get that done. How you make agreements with people like Johnny O and others who have also a vision for the future, who are trying to do things in a different way, to really build a different metropolitan area, understanding we're part of a whole. You know,
and we talked to Stuart Pittman about that last week, Anne Arundel County, just saying, look, at some point, Baltimore, the counties can't just hold their nose and say that's their problem, nor can Annapolis. And I live at the Inner Harbor, and one of the reasons you're here and we finally got to meet is, you know, I own property at the Inner Harbor. My wife and I own a beautiful place. We tried to sell it 2 years ago. We can't get anybody to walk through it, literally.
Right.
You know, property that we should be able to sell at some relative value to where we are. And this is long before COVID. This is the era of Trump and post-Freddie Gray. And now, you know, when we founded Baltimore Positive, I knew Catherine Pugh was incompetent. The day we started, it was literally Dutch Ruppersberger and us over Pizza John's looking up. She was, you know, the feds were coming into her house that day. I didn't know how corrupt it was. You know, the corruption is at the heart of all of this, right? For everything around Sheila, everything around the city, everything around where all the money goes, that, and Catherine Pugh, I think for all of us who vote in the city, and I know you've escaped out to the county on us, Mark, but, you know, share a common thought that that you don't even live in the city, but you need the city fixed. Everybody should want the city fixed. And when it breaks my heart when I hear people, and these are Trumpers, you know, at Harford County, Emerald County, saying, I'm never going back to the city. Never. Squeegee. Never. 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 Never going to an Oriole game. And I'm thinking to myself, that we've got to change. That's up to the people in the city need to make it more hospitable. You know, I mean, all these things you're talking about, all they see is the murder number, the crime, and what's on Fox 45, you know?
Yep, no, I agree. I agree. You know, and just to add here real quick, I'm an accidental county resident.
Well, I got a couch here, Mark, if you want to come back, you know.
Mark, I said, even as county executive in my years in county government, that there was never any doubt that Mark's a city boy at heart, and an accidental county resident is the way to put it. Mark, I mean, looking at this election, this is a fascinating election. If the polls are to be believed, pretty much everyone can win it, with the exception of the incumbent mayor. It appears that Mayor Young is not going to be reelected. But it looks like any one of the other five candidates can win. What's your, you know, as we broadcast this, we're a matter of days away, literally, from an election. What's your take as we come up to June 2nd as to the state of the race?
Well, you know, we saw the latest poll, and it's what a lot of us have thought was the case anyway. This is a really interesting dynamic at the moment. You've got Mary Miller, Brandon Scott, and Sheila Dixon, and I think they clearly are one of those three will be the next mayor. Hey, let me start this way. First, I think it's a travesty that the next mayor is going to be elected with maybe 16% of the primary votes.
Isn't that amazing?
That's
you've been very vocal, Mark. Mark, talk about that, because you've been vocal about the need for a change in the law that require runoff. Talk to folks about that.
Well, I'd like to see us pass a charter amendment and also take it to the state legislature to change the law so that if nobody wins 50.1%. of the vote in the primary or the general election in Baltimore City, then you have to go to a runoff, whether 2 or 3 weeks later, whatever that number might be. So you actually have a democratic process. We have the most undemocratic process. It's absurd that somebody who wins a plurality, maybe a small plurality of the primary vote is going to be the next mayor. That's unjust. It's not democratic.
Mark, how does someone? I was on a Zoom conference yesterday, and that was one of the topics. And these were people very much invested in the future of Baltimore City. And their concern is what you just said, and I'm going to put it to you in the form of a question. Can someone who is elected, I'll bump your 16% a little higher, let's say they get 21 or 22%, can someone who gets elected in a city where 80% of the people voted for someone else, can that person govern successfully coming out of that election?
That person still has to win in November. I'm just going to throw that in. Go ahead.
Yeah, they do, but the Republicans are not going to win in Baltimore.
Right.
And to run an independent campaign is very tough. Sheila Dixon tried it, and it's very tough to do that, to run a write-in campaign. It's almost impossible to win that way. But yeah, sure, they can govern. But I think it would have its difficulties. Because, you know, once you're mayor, you have all this power, and you, if you're actually going to do things and change things, you can build a popularity and support, despite the fact that you only had 16 to 20% of the vote in the primary and won, and became the mayor.
Give us an objective analysis, Mark, of keeping it real simple. Let's focus on the three that you said you think can win. You believe the next mayor is going to be Mary Miller, Sheila Dixon, or Brandon Scott. That's the Steiner files for today. So taking those three, give us a quick thumbnail of what you see as strengths of each one and the weaknesses of each one.
Well, I think Mary Miller is extremely bright, and I think she does believe in the city and has the best interest of the city at heart. I really don't believe that Mary Miller really understands the depth of the issues that face the city or how to address them. I think she's been a little disconnected from that. And I think that, that for argument's sake, somebody else wins the primary. The first thing that I would do if I was a vice mayor candidate and it wasn't Mary Miller was to bring her into the administration quickly.
Nestor has said that repeatedly, by the way. Nestor has said that should he be elected mayor, one of his first calls would be to Mary Miller.
And quite frankly, the second would be to Theroux and say, bring that crime plan in here. Let's talk about that.
Well, we can argue about that. I'm not so sure I agree with Theroux's crime plan at all.
I don't agree, but I would say he has a real one where, other than Harrison's crime plan, which is where we are, and that's the standard, right, to say what we're doing with Harrison is what we're doing, right? And Mary agrees with that, and I agree with that to some degree. But I do think whatever we're doing right now, the people aren't happy with that. Certainly the counties aren't happy with that. And the perception of business in the economy, the perception of people would buy my home are not happy with that, right?
No, yeah, I think that's true. I mean, but Theroux has, yeah, I mean.
Before we jump to Theroux, you gave us Mary. Give us the thumbnail on Brandon. Strengths, weaknesses.
So Brandon, I think, and I mean, he gets his bum rap about not being experienced enough. I think there's a lot of kind of racial overtones to that, even though there's a lot of older black church women who probably think the same. He's not that much younger than O'Malley was when O'Malley became
career.
And his team will make
that point over and over, Mark. They'll say, how about Martin O'Malley? How about Johnny O? They'll point to Johnny O.
That's right, Johnny O.
He's doing a great job.
He's been on the council for 9 years. He chaired one of the most significant committees. He's been president for a year. I mean, he does have some chops. I think is probably his biggest drawback is that people think he's too young. People don't take him seriously. I think that's really true. That's one of his biggest drawbacks. His interesting poll showed that he has a vast majority of people under 50 are supporting him, white and black, which I think is an interesting phenomenon. Sheila was on her way to being a great mayor. And I've known Sheila since she was 23 years old. We both worked at Baltimore Prep together on the southwest side of the city, working with kids. But, you know, as much as I like her personally, and I think she was great when she was mayor, I think Baltimore has to move on. And most people in the city feel that way. It's interesting when you watch this race. It's disturbing, too, that I find that there's a body of voters, mostly black in the city, who are going to be with Sheila no matter what happens. And they're solidly going to be behind her for lots of reasons about the black community feeling left out of the economic development of this city and left out of the process, despite black elected officials and that white folks went after Sheila. That's it's a mindset and thinking. So they're going to be behind Sheila. On the other side, you've got Mary Miller. I mean, I am just flabbergasted by every time I talk to somebody white in Baltimore, a friend or a colleague or just somebody I'm in a conversation with, they're voting for Mary Miller. And so I go, why? Because they say she is the one who can manage and make this and turn the city around. She has what it takes. And I said, well, then let's look at some of the other candidates. Why would she have it any more than, let's say, Brandon? So to me, it's amazing to watch this racial divide in the city, which I find extremely disturbing, but also very real.
Well, and so real that the black butterflies talked about. Like, it's talked about in every one of these Zooms and every single conversation. So I don't think we're not talking about tough issues where maybe 12 years ago, 16 years ago, there would be some undertone of all of that. But I think, you know, the cards are on the table when Mary Miller just speaks out and speaks about it pretty directly, about the racial divide and redlining and things that candidates around here never talked about, right?
We can thank Lawrence Brown. Lawrence Brown, who the professor who was at Morgan, is now at Wisconsin, brilliant scholar, is the one who brought us the white L and the black butterfly. He's the one who made us start talking about that. He really took his scholarship and turned it into a community conversation that made people realize what we were facing. We got to remember Lawrence. He's a great guy and he's brilliant.
Well, Mark, let's even build out on that. Do you have enough time to go a few more minutes, Mark? What's your schedule?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, great. Because we may end up breaking this one up into two episodes because there's so much to talk about here. Talking about the black butterfly, the white owl, we even took it to a broader discussion recently with Ryan Cassie, who wrote a terrifically thought-provoking article in Baltimore Magazine called Fix Baltimore. And he talked, Mark, he brought out again an issue that's been discussed all the way back to 1948, this issue of we need to really think about merging Baltimore City and Baltimore County again, and perhaps even parts of Anne Arundel, and that these artificial lines really have been detrimental, and he gives the history of it. We know it's politically almost impossible to do. What are your thoughts about that big idea, Mark?
Oof, that's you. It's got so many facets to it. good Lord. I mean, it would be really hard to pull off. I think you get a lot of people in all three jurisdictions going, what? I'm not not really supporting that kind of idea for lots of different reasons. I am not opposed to it. I mean, I think Baltimore County, you know, in some ways has to also get its act together around its representation. When you have a county that's, what, 40% communities of color now, and you got one black council person. So there's some issues that the county has to address too. But I think that'd be so hard to pull off, Don. I mean, I can't see how that could politically pull that off. I meant to talk to Ron about that because I read his piece, and I think Ron's a really great thinker, a great journalist. He's a really, really thought-provoking guy. He had some
examples in other large states and cities where it had happened. Don Hutchinson, had Don on, Mark, and Don talked about the fact that he thought it was a really important idea. But again, as he said, none of us who ever sat in that chair out there ever saw it as doable. I mean, and that includes folks like Ted Venatulis and Don Hutchinson.
Well, there goes your politics, Don. Folks. Everybody realizes it's a good idea, yet nobody wants to do it. And Mark, I always say this. When I'm in New York and I'm in the subway underneath anywhere in that city, I think to myself, whose idea was this? And what political capital did they have to use to say we're going to build something that 30 years from now people will actually use? And that was palatable. And then it got done,
So you raised a really important piece here. So how could this happen? If you think about how it could happen, I think that you have to, I used to call myself a revolutionary. I'm going to be a pragmatic revolutionary instead. So let's think about how you would how you might change that. And like, maybe you change it by doing something that you alluded to, which is that maybe if the three jurisdictions actually work together on transportation,
yeah,
creating a system that unites the communities, maybe you work together to, this would be an anathema of some people, but you think about how you might be able to make the school system slowly relate to one another and allow students going back and forth depending on where and what they wanted to study. Supposing you looked at it in terms of economic development and how you take something like the harbor and build a commercial system and the commercial harbor and unite Baltimore City County and Anne Arundel County around those issues.
Well, it's pretty fundamental, right, Mark? A strong Baltimore is a strong Towson, is a strong White Marsh, is a strong Reisterstown, is a strong, right?
Right.
I mean, that's fundamental until somebody has to vote on it.
So as I'm saying, so maybe you don't, maybe it's something that you don't have a vote on. Maybe it's something that leaders who are inspired start working on and building, you know, I mean, that to me, maybe that's the way to approach it. To really begin to integrate our metropolitan area, and then that it becomes almost, it morphs into something that you can then have the political conversation in my daughter's generation, maybe, or my, I have daughters who are 50 and I have a daughter who's 23. So, I mean, in either daughter's generation can kind of come up and really make those changes. But maybe that's how it has to happen. But I think you can have a discussion, a serious discussion about starting with transportation and economic development around the harbor and then maybe even education to talk about how we would begin to do that. Maybe, you know, giving kids a right in Baltimore City to look, Baltimore School for the Arts, where I taught for 11 years, is a place we accepted county students.
And people, you know, Mark, the important thing is, right, is that these are big ideas that you and Nestor are talking about, and we need folks out in the public arena talking about big ideas and talking about big ideas. Catch people up, Mark, on where they can find Mark Steiner. Tell us a little bit about the Center for Emerging Media, what you're working on, and what you're proud of that you've been accomplishing with it.
Oh my! Well, so you know, it's been a sojourn. I mean, the center's been around for like 20 some years now, through WYPR and WEAA and all the other work we've done. I've been doing a lot of work right now is consulting over a place called The Real News that kind of was falling apart and coming it back together. I've been helping them out with some stuff. I've been working there for a bit, and we have. Some projects going, but they're not ready for public announcement just yet at the center. There's a couple of major projects I'm working on that I'm hoping to get. I'm working on getting funded. One is a stage radio play that I'm working on about a piece of Maryland history that is actually national history we've forgotten about that I'm working on. And I'm working on another project of an interview series. So I mean. But I don't want to jump the gun until I have them out there.
Well, what's the piece, Mark, when you look back at the work you've done? And you've done, you went to Vietnam, and you've done some amazing stuff. What's the one piece, if somebody put you on the spot, I know it's like picking between children, but if somebody said to you, Mark, pick one series or one piece that you worked on, that you produced, that was a finished product, that you, when you look back at the end of your day, say, man, that was a good one. What would it be?
Oh, man, that is so hard to do. I mean, it's so hard to do. It really is. I mean, you know, the piece we did on the Just Words, which was a series I did on the voices of the working poor in the Baltimore metropolitan area, the one that won us a Peabody. I mean, that was a piece of work I did that meant a lot. Shared Weight was our Vietnam series, which I thought was unique and different, you know, bringing together the people who fought on all sides of that conflict in Vietnam at one time to tell stories about what happened at that period. I mean, that was something I'm proud of. The Alabama Chronicles, my work with the MLK's barber and that story that we told. The Baltimore Uprising stuff we did with Freddie Gray. I mean, it's hard. I mean, there was a lot. I mean, I can't even
tell people. Tell people about the MLK barber story, Mark. Tell. I can hear people in their car going, "Wait a minute, MLK's barber." And you know, they say, "Come on, Steiner, come back to that. Tell us a little bit about MLK's barber."
Well, God, this was So these two colleagues in Baltimore brought this guy Nelson Malden to my studio, WEAA. And I interviewed him on my radio show, and he was Martin Luther King's barber in the early 1950s, at the beginning of the bus boycott. And he told these incredible stories about King, and he is a fascinating man. And so we got to be really friendly and sort of writing back and forth and talking on the phone, so we went down and told his story. And we did a very short mini doc on his work, I was hoping it was going to be a much bigger film. It didn't turn out to be a bigger film, but it was a great film that we produced on him, and it was just an amazing story. Pieces of stories about King and people on that we learned from the Montgomery bus boycott and how it changed America and people we never heard of before. And we were able to tell that story. And Nelson's just a gem. I mean, he's in his 80s. He is just a great raconteur. He's just the kind of guy that Nelson Malden is.
Well, it has been a pleasurable first visit with you, Mark Steiner. I hope it is not our last. We need you on the wall, my man. So come on down to the city here.
Nestor, I thought you might enjoy this one.
Well, you know,
I appreciate the invite. I really appreciate the invite. I had a great time.
Well, we'll tell some more stories on the aftermath of the election here coming up in a couple weeks. We're going to send everybody out to see you for all that you're doing of Real News and all the stuff that you've ever done. We appreciate you. And this will not be the last visit at Baltimore Positive. You're too positive to not be on Baltimore Positive, Mark Steiner.
Thank you.
You got it. Mark Steiner, the man, the myth, the legend, our first time ever. We still have never met physically in the same room. We just did an hour and 12 minutes of radio together. I tell you what, shout out to State Fair. I'm going to need some chicken and waffles and some shrimp and grits soon. Big thanks to our friends at Fadley's for sponsoring us. Damie's there. They're shipping crab cakes all over the world. They shipped one into my belly curbside the other day. I got some mac and cheese here. Fadley's, State Fair, our friends at Moeller and Gary Realty, still selling houses with masks on, still doing it on the internet, buying and showing. They can list your home. They can sell your home. Our friend Jeff Moeller and Don's son, Jeff Moeller, Moeller and Gary Realty. And last but never least, Taharka Ice Cream. I'm going to hold the pistachio up because my wife finished this off. She's got the thing for the pistachio. I'm going to be hard-pressed to get that. She's probably not going to get any Honey Graham from me either. But luckily, Taharka is our new sponsor for Baltimore Positive. So big shout-out. Nothing more made in Baltimore, perhaps, than them and us. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. Keeping calm, staying local, and always Baltimore Positive.